dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. We often turn to our first guest, Russ Dahlan, to help us understand what's happening in a very important front in that war, our own, well, some say it's a backyard. I think of it as our front yard, namely Latin America, and specifically the long-suffering country of Venezuela, whose people are now being subjected to ever more horrific privation. And Russ has spent a lot of time in that country. He reports on it in his very important publication, the Latin American Herald Tribune. He is a businessman with a lot of experience in the region and beyond, and we're always grateful for his expertise. Russ, thank you so much for joining us again. Welcome back.
Thank you, Secretary Gaffney. It's always an honor and a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you. Well, listen, you have been following this situation as it's been unfolding, unraveling, I guess one might say, in Venezuela. Give us just a quick sense of the lay of the land as you see it, Russ.
Well, the entrance of Russian troops has definitely upped the ante for the U.S. to try and roll back this communist, narco-dictating, corrupt regime that's taken over this country and refuses to let go with the help of the Cubans. But now the Russians have deployed troops there.
Well, tell us what that means, what number and what kind.
Well, they did it very obviously. I mean, the plane at different points, there were two jets that came over. One of the biggest Air Force cargo jets in the world brought in equipment. And another jet that's used to ferry troops also came over, stopping in Syria and Dakar on the way. We tracked it. It did turn off its transponder on the way, but it landed in broad daylight at the country's most commercial airport. So they weren't trying to hide it. And they have certainly gotten their bang for very little buck, which is what the Russians are only capable of, because they don't have the supply line to keep and support troops to fight a battle in Venezuela, so far from their home base. But it didn't take that many troops for them to do that and stop the U.S. from enforcing any of its so-called red lines in Syria to great effect. And Bashar Assad is still in power there. As a matter of fact, the Venezuelan foreign minister yesterday was meeting with Bashar Assad in Syria. And commiserating that they were in the same situation. And thank God the Russians were there to help both of them.
Yeah. We're going to talk a little bit more about that Syrian situation with Shoshana Bryan momentarily. But let me just drill down on what the prospects are under these circumstances with power blackouts and lack of food, lack of clean water, so many other hardships. For the government that has now been recognized by some 50 countries, including the United States, namely the presidency of Juan Guaido, is there anything left of that ambitious effort as you see it at the moment, or have things sort of stalled out, Russ Dahlan?
Well, we're so used to reality show change that every hour TV show ends with a happy ending. I'm afraid life is a little bit messier than that, and oftentimes we forget. The sanctions, the more serious sanctions of embargoing Venezuelan oil, as well as embargoing the products that flow back to Venezuela from the United States, have only been in effect for just over 2 months. For the last 3 weeks, there has been no Venezuelan oil coming to the United States. At the same time, they've been having these blackouts, which has also hurt their production, which means that they have less oil to sell. The Russians have been helping them by shipping the oil to India, where the Russians purchased at a very expensive price, a very sophisticated refinery on the border with Pakistan and India. The Chinese, obviously, are also still helping. Both of them are owed money by the Venezuelans. As a matter of fact, the Venezuelans also bought billions of dollars of arms from the Russians, including sophisticated Sukhoi fighter jets, tanks, the T-72 tanks, almost 100 of them, helicopters, and even most ambitiously, the S-300 anti-aircraft missile defense system that that was also deployed in Syria. So, as a matter of fact, the payment on that was due. Venezuela's defaulted on that billions of dollars of debt. $3.15 billion, I think, is what's remaining of that debt to the Russians. They were due to pay a $100 million payment by the end of March. They did not make it. I think there's a 30-day grace period, the Russians have informed them. But this would be the third time that they've defaulted if they don't come up with $100 million to pay the Russians, which I'm sure they will fine, because they want to keep their patron happy.
Yeah, or at least their patron. That's the key piece. So if this situation is sort of continuing to worsen, what would you be recommending, Rust Allen, the United States government do to try to have it come out better? I mean, what options are there, as you see it, for America at the moment?
We will, as the next stage, have to increase our sanctions on Cuba, because the Cubans are very much – Venezuela would have fallen if it hadn't been for the Cubans keeping Maduro feeling intact and safe, and basically threatening him that he's got no place to go, which a lot of these narco-trafficking generals and leaders don't have any place to go as well. So the – problem is that embargoes don't work against the Cubans, and the Cubans are very, very much running the shop in Venezuela. The next step is that we have to do more serious things. We're going to go after Cuba, put embargoes, more embargoes on Cuba, stop the cruise ships from going there, employ the Helms-Burton Act that will also allow more people to go after Cuba, and really start, you know, when a dog is biting your brother's leg, you beat them with a stick to try and get them to release it. Otherwise, they just keep holding on.
Well, this is a crude metaphor for what we've got to do, but it does seem to me that your focus on trying to pressure those who are propping up this regime makes eminent sense, as does the recognition that it seems to me a humanitarian intervention is increasingly required here. How that can be accomplished and with whose support, obviously we'd need that of the Brazilians and the Colombians, but the situation is leading to catastrophe for sure. And that catastrophe will translate into the migration of immense numbers of people that the neighboring states can't accommodate, and many of them will be coming here in due course. We'll be talking with Rosemary Jenks later in the program about the problem we're already having with the border. This would only get worse. So this is a subject to which we will return with you. Russ, I'm afraid we're out of time for today, but do come back to us. And thanks so much for the reporting that you're doing on this at the Latin American Herald Tribune. I know you'll keep it up, and we'll look forward to talking with you again soon. Next up, Shoshana Bryan joins us, as promised. We'll talk with her about Syria, what's going on in the Middle East more generally, and the prospect for a peace plan between Israel and the Palestinians. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back, and let me say a particular welcome to our guest. She is Shoshana Bryan, a very experienced, not to be confused with old, but very experienced and very influential analyst, observer, commentator, and resource on matters involving the Middle East. She is the senior director of the Jewish Policy Center and the editor of its In Focus Quarterly, which can be obtained at jewishpolicycenter.org. It's a delight to have her back, as always. Shoshana, it's been too long. Thank you for joining us. Welcome.
Thank you, Frank.
Well, I've got about 4 hours worth of conversation with you that is going to have to be truncated and fit into 12 minutes. So let's do this smartly. You've written a very powerful piece about what's being done to divvy up the Syrian corpse, as you put it, and that there are some rather ominous implications for both Israel and the United States and how that's being done. Tell us about it.
Interestingly, the Syrian government has lost control of its country. It controls nothing. It has no military. It controls nothing. The assumption was that Russia was going to be the governing power there, more or less, which the Israelis could have lived with. However, it appears now that the Russians are not going to be the governing power. The Russian naval base at Latakia is about to undergo Iranian management. The Iranians are still, yes, they're, no kidding, so far they say it's just port management, the Russians will still be there. But it's hard to imagine how the Russians will leave their military sitting in Latakia if the Iranians are running the port. It's very complicated. So the Russians are sort of going home. They're maintaining political influence, but it is Iran on the ground that will have troops, that will have Shiite troops. Most of them are Pakistani and Afghan Shiites. You know, those are minorities in their own country. So the Iranians have said, hey, listen, fight the jihad here in Syria, and we'll pay you a lot of money, and we'll take you out of the rotten countries you live in. And then they put them in another rotten country.
But repopulating another country that was not principally Shia to this point. And very, very troubling that they're obviously expanding their footprint beyond that port facility. They're coming quite close to the Golan, among other things, they and their Hezbollah proxies, which brings me to the next topic, Shoshana, which is the Iranian presence near the Golan has made all the more important the recognition by the United States of Israel's sovereign control of that territory. It also, unfortunately, is the case that Israel may need that territory to protect its people against the forces that are being arrayed very close by from Tehran and Beirut. Talk about how serious a threat that represents as you see it.
That depends. That's what the president, in my opinion, had in mind when he acknowledged Israeli sovereignty on the Golan. That is that Israel has to be able to fight Iran in Syria, and that's another way to do it. And he's being very helpful in that. The question I have for the future is, how long can Iran do what it's doing? Conditions in Iran are so bad, and we have been so good at cutting off their money. Of the five countries that got waivers for buying Iranian oil, three of them have said, never mind, we're not buying it anyway. So you have very little Iranian oil sales. They are now going to have to make a big decision between what's happening at home and what they can spend in Syria, in Iraq, in Africa, in Yemen, places where they've made their mark. They're going to be between the rock and the hard place. I suspect they're going to have to pull back to some extent. If we can hold the line, if the U.S. can hold the line on money, and Israel can hold the line on territorial integrity, it is possible that we are seeing the beginning of Iran having to make those decisions.
Keep pushing, keep the pressure on, keep holding the line against them in Iran. What Israel is doing in addition, it seems, with some regularity, is actually bloodying the Iranians with airstrikes and, I presume, other kinds of activities on the ground as well. To the extent that the people of Iran have any say in any of this, there's pretty widespread opposition, it seems, to what the mullahs are doing with Hezbollah, with Assad in Syria. It's the diversion of their very, very limited resources, as you say, to that country. Is this likely, in your estimation, Shoshana, to further serve to undermine that government, which would be very much, I think, in the interest not just of Israel, of course, and this country, but the entire world, would it not?
Absolutely. The battle cry of the Iranian, what I call the rolling rebellion, because it goes all over the country and all kinds of people, is not for Gaza, not for Syria, my life only for Iran. That's what they're yelling. And the Iranian government understands, and especially with these floods this week, where a lot of people died who really didn't have to die. They have no water management. The flooding was preventable in a lot of cases. The people know that they are being taken. and they don't like it. Yeah. And that's good.
Yeah. Well, again, if they have a say, and we need to be supporting them and exercising that say, it seems to me. Hey, Shoshana, let me switch to another part of this battle space, and that is what's going on in the Gaza Strip at the moment. It is, of course, under the control of another terrorist organization, Hamas. Hamas has been, of late, using increasingly violent means to attack Israel at the border fence and across it. That is, as you have pointed out, possibly as much function of trying to obscure what's happening inside the Gaza Strip itself. Tell us about that.
People of the Gaza Strip, like the people of Iran, understand that they're being taken for a ride, that whatever money comes in there, Qatari money, Red Cross money, whatever it is not being spent on them. It's not being spent on housing or education or whatever. It is being spent to allow Hamas to build its arsenal against Israel, and they don't like it. And for the first time, we've seen serious demonstrations in Gaza City against Hamas. And Hamas needs to turn that anger against Israel. And they say, no, no, it's Israel's fault that you're hungry, and it's Israel's fault that you have no jobs. And it sort of works, but I think it works less and less. And again, the more you can support the people in their anger against their own government, the better it is.
Right.
I'm shocked by the Gazans who do this, by the way. They're very brave people.
They are indeed, because this is a particularly ruthless gang of what I call Sharia supremacists who are having no compunction about killing their own people and are doing rather a lot of it, as well as making them suffer unbelievably. I think you, among others, have pointed out that part of the privation that the people of Gaza have been experiencing is a function of the diversion of large amounts of resources, both financial and material, to, among other things, building tunnels under the border with Israel for the purposes of attacking Israeli, settlements and communities, no?
Communities, absolutely. Absolutely. They use the money, it's tunnels, it's weapons, it's paying the Hamas soldiers, the Hamas terrorists, instead of building an infrastructure for their people. Gaza was not a poor place, by the way. Gaza was not a poor place. It is now, but it wasn't. People worked there. People lived there.
Among them Jews, until the government of Israel foolishly vacated the place.
Well, that's, they did it. We can't undo that. But Gaza was not a bad place for Palestinians to live. They lived and they worked, and now they live and they don't work.
Yeah. Or don't live, as the case may be. Shoshana Bryan is our guest. Let me ask you to turn, if you would, with this sort of rather ominous background, Shoshana, to something that we're told is in the offing once the elections are done in Israel. And it's anybody's guess how long that will actually take to sort, not the elections themselves, but the what flows from it. But Shoshana, what should we make of the brooded idea that the president will be advancing a new peace plan? When I say the president, I mean, of course, President Trump, a new peace plan for Israel and the Palestinians in the aftermath of that election.
There is definitely something in the offing. The rumor is that he's going to lean on Israel, that he's given Israel all these gifts, and then he's going to lean on Israel now to give the Palestinians gifts. I frankly do not believe it. It is the mechanism that has failed since the Oslo Accord, and I cannot imagine the president right now, our president, being Bill Clinton or being John Kerry or being any of those people who just said, okay, Israel, I gave you something, now give everything away to the Palestinians. I don't think so. On top of which, you have to understand, the Palestinians have already said they reject it. Whatever it is, they reject it. So I don't see a lot of hope in it, but I really don't think that it's one of those things that will come down heavily on Israel because the president wants to do that. I don't think so.
Well, to the extent that the pursuit of this plan, this idea for forging what has eluded every president before this one, namely some durable and just peace between the parties, this seems extremely unlikely under present circumstances. Is there anything, Shoshana Bryan, that you could point to in what's going on in the Palestinian community, either in Gaza or even in the so-called West Bank, the Palestinian Authority, that would give rise to confidence that there might be partners for peace and that the peace would, in fact, be durable and just?
No, because it's missing the single essential function. In order to have peace between Palestinians and Israelis, the Palestinians have to agree that Israel is a legitimate and permanent part of the region, and they don't agree to that. Sadat agreed to that and got the Sinai back. King Hussein agreed to that, made a peace treaty. The Palestinians do not believe that the state of Israel is a legitimate place, and therefore they're not going to make peace with it. They really think it's theirs.
Yeah. Shoshana Bryan, you understand that so well. Thank you for coming aboard to talk us through it and for the great work that you do at the Jewish Policy Center. Again, folks, you can find her writings and much more at jewishpolicycenter.org. Shoshana, be well. Come back to us again soon, if you would.
More with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. Another of my favorite people is Rosemary Jenks. She is the splendid director for government affairs at an indispensable organization, Numbers USA. It is one of the most important of the many non-governmental organizations that are trying to have some sense made of the immigration policies and border security of the United States, but it's right at the top of the list as far as I'm concerned. And Rosemary keeps it there. Rosemary, thank you so much for joining us. It's always good to have a chance to catch up with you, even though the time at hand seems to be a little, well, shall we say, depressing when it comes to trying to make good decisions and have the right outcomes in terms of immigration policy. Am I missing something?
It is great to be with you, as always, Frank, and you are not missing anything. It is sort of a depressing time, but, you know, I think there are a lot of things that should be happening that aren't. We obviously have a massive crisis on our southern border, and nobody seems to know what to do about it.
Well, you do, I know. But before we get to that, let's just talk a little bit about the ground truth. We still have people, including, as far as I can tell, virtually the entire Democratic Party in Congress, insisting that there is no crisis. There's nothing to see here, folks. Move along. The president couldn't be more clear that he disagrees, and he is issuing, with some regularity now, some rather remarkable threats, one might say incredible threats, threats that he seems to, you know, sort of back and fill on with some regularity as well. But is it a crisis in fact? Why is it that people don't seem to be regarding it as such? And then let's talk a little bit about what we could be doing about it right this minute, Rosemary Jenks.
There's no question that this is a crisis. We are seeing numbers of illegal immigrants that we have not seen since the early 2000s. And the big difference is that in the early 2000s, it was mostly single Mexican males coming for work, and we could just turn them right back across the border. It was very easy. But now they are mostly Central Americans coming with children, and not necessarily their own children. They all have been taught now that all they have to do is show up with a child and they will be and claim asylum, and they will be let into the United States, given a work permit, and then they can just disappear into the country and do exactly what they intended to do, which is work in the United States and send money back home. So we can't immediately deport. First of all, we can't immediately deport anyone who says that they want asylum. And second, we can't immediately deport Central Americans because they have to go through an immigration proceeding, and then we have to actually put them on an airplane and send them back, which is a whole separate thing from, you know, just turning somebody back across the border.
To say nothing of an expensive proposition, where does the money come for flying these people to wherever they came from? Rosemary?
Yeah, well, and that is a huge part of the problem. You know, you have to, first of all, wait until you have a big enough group to fill an airplane. then you have to find the airplane and pay for it. And the pilot has to agree that he's willing to take these people who may or may not be, you know, handcuffed or opposing their deportation in some physical way. And so it is, it's a huge process. You also have to get travel documents for them from the home country. So the Central American countries have to issue them travel documents. So it is a process, and that has created a massive problem where we have filled up our detention facilities. We're not able to detain these folks. So they're essentially just being given a work permit with a date sometime in the future to appear for an asylum hearing. Most of them will not appear for that asylum hearing. And then they will be ordered deported in absentia, and they will remain in the United States working illegally for however long, until they either get caught or decide to retire back home.
Or they get an amnesty, which, of course, is a prospect that only reinforces the magnet that they obviously see to come to this country in the first place. And I just can't underscore forcefully enough what you've just said about the fact that they're using children, in some cases not their own, as sort of human shields to make this sort of scam possible. And that is having profound implications. There's a lot of talk now, Rosemary, about fixing the amnesty provisions in law today and trying to make this less of a feasible option for those coming across the border. Do you see much prospect for that?
Unfortunately, it appears that, well, first of all, the Democrats have a clear incentive to keep the border open. And that is, you know, future voters, future amnesty pushes. The census is coming up. And of course, everyone in the country, legally or illegally, will be counted in the census. Hopefully, we will have a question about citizenship in the census. But so this crisis works to the advantage of Democrats, unfortunately, and they appear to be crass enough to want to keep it going. But I also think that their hatred for Donald Trump precludes them from any rational conversation about legislative fixes. So, you know, I don't see much prospect for anything good happening on immigration in Congress. There are, however, a number of things that the president, that the administration can do that would dramatically slow down this surge coming across the southern border. And one of those is to stop issuing work permits. A court has ruled that once an asylum application has been filed, after it is pending for 150 days, then the alien has to be issued a work permit. But before that, there is no requirement. This is purely discretionary that we're handing out work permits. And that work permit is, of course, exactly what these folks are coming here for. So if you take away the work permit, you have taken away one of the incentives. We have to get more detention space. And whether that means, you know, a tent city, the military building a tent city, whatever it takes, that needs to be done. There has to be a way to hold on to these folks until they are processed. There was a proposal just this past week that the Border Patrol could actually start doing credible fear interviews immediately. That's a fantastic idea. It is, you know, very simple to tell the Border Patrol agents what the standards are and have them, while they're processing these folks, because every person who comes across the border has to be processed, fingerprinted, you know, their name and information filled out so that they can be given the notice to appear sometime in the future. The Border Patrol could very easily at that point say, you know, okay, do you have a credible fear? And if they say, I'm afraid of gangs or cartels or whatever, that's not a qualifying fear for asylum purposes. So you deny them credible fear, you can put them into expedited removal proceedings, which means they, by law, have to see an immigration judge within 10 days. And then you send them home.
But again, the mechanics of that are still not trivial, but at least you could accelerate them. And Rosemary, let me just ask you a couple of questions, because I'm with you that we ought to be focusing on what we can do. The president has talked about, and this may be, again, a threat that he's backing away from, cutting funding that is currently in the pipeline or planned for Central American countries with the idea that we would make them better places and therefore people who live there would not want to come here. I'm not sure that there's much evidence that that does work, or at least is working at the moment. But we have finite resources, of course, as you know, and it does seem to me that money, if it is in limited supply, has to be triaged, has to be spent in such a way that we can maximize the impact, not simply try to do everything that we'd like, even if it's inadequately funded. So if you had to choose, wouldn't it be obviously a higher priority to prevent people who are coming here illegally from getting into the country through barriers and technology and all the rest of it along our border, rather than sending gobs of that money elsewhere, whatever the rationale for it is, when we have less confidence that it will work for that purpose?
Yes. I mean, there's no question that the priority has to be protecting the sovereignty and security of the United States. Unfortunately, however, the president doesn't have the option of taking the money that is currently going in foreign aid to Central America or Mexico and turning that into border security funding, because that is not allowed under the appropriations rules. Congress has appropriated that money for foreign affairs, and the president can't use it for something else. So he can decide we're not going to give it to Central America or Mexico, but he can't say we're going to instead use it for border security. So in terms of that, he's in a bit of a catch-22. However, you know, the fact that Mexico is allowing all of these Central Americans to cross through the Mexican southern border and then come up to the United States, and in some cases is actually assisting them to get to the U.S. border, that's a big problem. And Mexico should have some consequences for that. So, you know, there are a variety of options that actually some of the states could do. For example, Oklahoma has a law that taxes remittances, foreign remittances. So if you go to a Western Union and you want to send money to Mexico or Central America, you have to pay a fee up front. And unless you're a legal U.S. resident who pays taxes, you don't get that fee back. So that is something that that all the states could do, or at least all the red states, that would actually start taking a chunk out of the remittance money that these countries are getting. And they completely rely on remittance money.
Mm-hmm. We'll be touching base with you for sure. Come back to us again very soon. General Rob Spalding will join us next, straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. It's a delight and high privilege, really, to say welcome to a man we've had a chance to discuss matters involving China and the national security of the United States with on several different occasions since he retired from a very distinguished career in the United States Air Force. His name is Brigadier General Robert Spalding. He formerly flew B-2 aircraft and has quite a considerable distinguished and decorated record of service to his country in uniform. Since he's taken it off, I'm pleased to say he's continued it, helping particularly with our understanding of the threat that he had an opportunity to take stock of in a variety of capacities, including at the Trump National Security Council and as our defense attaché on the ground in Beijing. And we're very grateful to him for the insights he's previously shared and those that he'll give us today about what's going on with China. Rob Spalding, welcome back. It's so good to have you with us, sir.
Thank you, Frank. It's good to be back.
I wanted to sort of kick this off, Rob, by noting that next week will be the 40th anniversary of the Taiwan Relations Act, which was an extraordinary piece of legislation to try to offset what was done through other channels to establish relations with the government of China in Beijing, but not completely cut loose friends and allies of ours in what's called the Republic of China on Taiwan. Could you just, in a sort of quick way, describe the history of this this relationship, this act, and that'll set us up for a conversation about where we are now with Taiwan?
Sure. I think just a general overview is the switch of diplomatic relations from the Republic of China to the People's Republic of China were all around the outreach of the Nixon administration towards China. And that was for the purpose of essentially balancing the Soviet Union. And so it was one of the requirements for us to get the Chinese to actually help us balance the military power of the Soviet Union going forward. And so once that outreach was made and once that those kind of initial agreements were in hand, it was only a matter of time. And so the details of the Taiwan Relation Act, official relations, I think, were changed in the Carter administration. And then, as a result, there was a lobbying effort in the Congress to ensure that we continued to have this close and personal relationship with the Republic of China in Taiwan. I would say that the purpose of that was to ensure that the Democratic Republic of China were free to kind of determine their own future on a path that that we had essentially come to an understanding with the People's Republic of China that would be peaceful and according to Western norms. In other words, if there was ever going to be a reunion between the two sides, that they would be under peaceful conditions in a way that the Republic of China was entirely comfortable with.
Yeah, it's a tough needle to thread, obviously, and I'm concerned that over the years we have probably signaled mostly by the restraint in living up to our commitment to help provide for the security of the people of Taiwan, that we've actually encouraged some of the ambitions that the Chinese have, as you say, made no secret of, that they intend to succeed in due course in reunifying the island with the mainland. So Rob Spalding, as a military man in particular, I'd like to ask you about the current threat that China poses to Taiwan in, various dimensions now, and whether, in your judgment, we're approaching the point where the Chinese may feel they have the correlation of forces, I guess is the old Soviet term for it, to take the island by force if need be.
Yeah, and as you know, Frank, for the last 6 years, I've been focused on how China, the People's Republic of China and the Chinese Communist Party, use globalization and the internet to undermine democracies everywhere. The times that I do focus on the military challenge, it's primarily focused on Taiwan, and it's with regard to the enormous imbalance of military force that's been created on the People's Republic of China's side of the Taiwan Strait. In other words, they've created a military force, especially with their use of ballistic and cruise missiles, conventional ballistic and cruise missiles, that really allows them to forestall a U.S. Coming to Taiwan's aid in the event of a crisis or a conflict, and really to saturate all of Taiwan's defenses in order to allow for a military invasion of the island. And so to the extent that as we go forward, there are considerably increasing tense relations between the two governments, that of the People's Republic of China and the Republic of China, the danger that I fear that's created by that imbalance is that the People's Republic of China and the Chinese Communist Party will see that they have the ability to actually effectuate a very quick recovery of the island before the United States has the ability to intervene.
Yeah. And this is, of course, being developed, this capacity to take the island in conjunction with pretty formidable capacity to interdict or at least hold at bay hold at risk at a minimum, hold at bay possibly our forces through their area and access denial and kind of capabilities. And General, let me just mention one other thing that our friend Rick Fisher has pointed out in a couple of settings, including on this program, the capacity of the Chinese to put large numbers of Chinese nationals in Taiwan in very short order, in the nature of sort of occupying literally every house on the island to ensure that they achieve the kind of control there is a facet of this building Chinese threat to the island that is quite extraordinary. Is that something that we should be alive to, as well as the missiles and the aircraft and the rest of it?
Oh, absolutely. Again, that goes on the side of, you know, what can China do just in terms of business, finance, economic, trade, immigration, and the internet to slowly turn the government of Taiwan in their favor. And that's what they've done very well with the Nationalist Party. You know, essentially there's this growing effort in the Nationalist Party to be more aligned with the People's Republic of China because of the efforts just like you're talking about. I think the big thing that we should be concerned about, and the thing that I am concerned about, is, you know, in terms of a Chinese style democracy, that's very vibrant within the Republic of China. There's another issue, which is the number of Republic of China's citizens who are actually dual citizens that are American citizens. So this risk of conflict actually creates a potential for conflict between, regardless of the Taiwan Relations Act, which essentially calls for us to continue to maintain Taiwan's defense, actually creates a risk of us being involved in a conflict. I think there's a lot of people in the United States who discount the Taiwan Relations Act as saying, well, that doesn't really force us into defending Taiwan. But at the end of the day, I don't know what the numbers are, but if you have significant American citizens that are dying in Taiwan, then that creates the further risk that you know, we actually could be involved in conflict. And, you know, the final piece is, you know, we have created a military that actually fights very well in the Middle East and Europe. China has created a military that actually prevents that military from being used in the Pacific. So we actually need to think differently about the weapons we buy and how we deploy our forces in the region in a way that would be effective in deterring the People's Republic of China from actually conducting an attack. One of the biggest things that I think is important in this case is the INF Treaty. I think the INF Treaty has prevented the United States from creating the type of force similar to what the Chinese Communist Party has created that would actually deter the PRC from invading.
Yeah. We have to leave it at that for the moment. General Robert Spalding, again, I cannot thank you enough for your continuing service to our country, sir, as well as that you've rendered in uniform. I hope you'll come back to us again, if you would, very soon. I hope the rest of you will come back to us on Monday, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.